Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Since time immemorial, humans have built tools and broken those tools, but then also repaired them. But today, our tools are computers, smartphones, cars, tractors, kitchen appliances, you name it. But the people who build those smart tools sometimes don't want us or our mechanics or our handy folk to fix them. And they've got their reasons, but so do the army of citizen consumers who are pushing back. This hour On Point, the growing right to repair movement. And you can join us. How has it gone for you when your laptop goes dark or your smartphone freezes or the check engine light goes on in your car? Do you know how to fix those things and want to, but somehow are stymied? And do you think manufacturers should be able to force you to go back to their dealer or their authorized repair center? And when you buy something and have to click accept on all the legalese, which says you don't actually own the inside of your products, what do you say to that? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Now, this right to repair movement really covers so much ground, so many products in our daily lives. But one place where it's very much on the minds of an entire community is in the farming community. So we're going to begin in Bertrand, Nebraska today. Tom Schwartz is a fifth generation farmer, now an organic farmer. His family farms some 700 acres. And in fact, they are in the middle of harvesting corn today. And Tom has come in from the harvest to talk with us. He's also president of the Phelps-Gosper County Farm Bureau and has a seat on the American Farm Bureau. He was also involved in lobbying for Nebraska's right to repair bill. So, Tom Schwartz, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meg. Meghna.
It's really great to have you today, and thanks so much for taking time out of the harvest to join us. So, first of all, tell us how, in your farming life, just on a day-to-day basis, how much has the inability to repair your farming equipment sort of gotten in the way of what you do?
Well, repair is still a critical part of what we do and will be probably for a long time. This morning, before I came in for this call, I was repairing a piece of equipment that we transfer grain with, and it was all mechanical. There was no high-tech stuff involved, so it was a relatively straightforward repair. But with our newer equipment, the tractors and combines and such, almost everything is operated by a computer system. So at that point, it becomes a lot more challenging.
So tell us about that, right? Because I think some people may have heard of a fight that has been going on with John Deere about their tractors as well. So when one of your tractors breaks down, like, what happens? What do you have to do?
Well, literally, in fact, yesterday I had a conversation with one of the neighbors, and they were unloading corn out of an auger wagon into a cart pulled by a tractor. And the tractor just stopped because a sensor had gone bad. And when this speed sensor goes out, the tractor just says it's in neutral, that's it. You aren't going to move that tractor for anything. And so the whole operation grinds to a halt in an instant. So you've got all these people standing around wondering what to do. You're trying to get a hold of someone to come out and repair the tractor, and it may be a relatively simple fix. It could be an extraordinarily simple fix. But today, because Deere doesn't want us messing around with their software and hardware, or well, software particularly, we've got to bring Deere out. They have essentially a monopoly on repair. And what we're concerned with is the ability that we'd like to have to access the computers and the software to the extent that we can communicate with the computer and the tractor and put repairs in place and get moving again. Because, you know, our harvest is our whole income.
Yeah.
You know, we literally, in a matter of minutes, can have a windstorm come in and lose. And we had this happen last year. We had 250 bushel corn that literally went 250 bushel corn in a short period of time.
Wow. Well, so Tom Schwartz, let me ask you though, when you call up John Deere and ask for help, and do they always, is their procedure always they want to send one of their folks out to fix the tractor or take a look at it? You can't get any on the phone support or online support?
We can get some help. It kind of depends on what the problem is.
Yeah.
We'll call in to the dealership, and we've got an excellent dealer here. I'm very happy with them. They do good work. But what we do is we will read off codes. We've got a screen in the tractor that actually will tell us, you know, what codes the tractor is throwing. We'll read that off to the shop foreman, and he'll try to diagnose it the best he can at that point. Now, if it's something that we can do, he'll tell us what to do, but more often than not, we have to have a tech come out, and they have to literally hook a computer up to the tractor and, you know, go through their job and then put in whatever components might be bad.
Yeah. So, I mean, just gone are the days where you could lift the hood, up the hood of your tractor, try to figure it out and get going again, is what you're saying.
Exactly. We've got older tractors here. When they break down, we just pull the component off, put the new component in, and away we go. But now, for instance, if a component goes bad, you've got to be able to link that component to the computer. You've got to be able to tell the computer, okay, it's okay, you've got a new component here, you need to hook up with it and operate. And we don't have that ability.
Okay. Tom Schwartz, stand by here for just a second, because you've really given us a sense about how, you know, this isn't just your smartphone breaking down. For many people, when they can't repair the equipment that they're using, or they're not allowed to repair it, it's their livelihoods we're talking about here. So, Tom, hang on for a second, because I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Nathan Proctor is joining us today. He's the director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair at the advocacy group, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. He's former national campaign director for USPIRG's New Economy team, and he joins me in the studio. Nathan Proctor, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what are the reasons that a company like John Deere gives to folks like Tom Schwartz to say, like only they and their authorized people can take a look at the tractors and Tom can't repair it?
Yeah. You know, I've been lobbying on right to repair all over the country, and there's a couple things that we hear. You know, we walk into a legislature, what the industry is saying in opposition. They say that there's a security risk to Tom fixing his own tractor. They say there's a safety risk. Maybe, you know, he doesn't do it well or hurts himself. They say, that they're really the only people we should be trusted to fix the equipment that we own. And
so hang on for just a second. Tom, do you own your tractor?
Yes, we purchased our tractors. We own them.
Yeah, so because as Nathan, as you were just saying, that perhaps the company though sees itself as still, even though folks like Tom have paid for the entirety of their tractor, that the technology within it, John Deere, just one of many companies, says it still belongs to them.
I mean, John Deere.
That's how
argued
they look at
that,
it. Yeah,
argued that before the Librarian of Congress through this process. To talking about copyright problems of like fixing tractors by hacking their tools. And they argued that you don't really own the piece of equipment, that you operate it under an implied user license. And so, I mean, you can imagine that that wasn't a popular thing to say to a yeah. bunch of people who just spent $500,000 on a combine, that no, you're actually just an implied user. You have an implied user license. You're not the true owner. Yeah, and it's obviously these problems when there's no access to independent repair and when the fundamental ownership of the device kind of is maintained by the manufacturer, you know, there's more problems than just the inconvenience and cost of, you know, proprietary repair. We also have this problem where there's an incentive for these manufacturers to push you to buy a new thing, especially for something like smaller electronics like a cell phone.
Right. So, Tom Schwartz, you were involved in lobbying for Nebraska's right to repair bill. Is that right?
Yes.
So tell
well,
me.
Well, yeah, I've helped what I could.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about what happened there. Does Nebraska have a right to repair law on the books now?
No. The bill was stalled in committee, and that's where it remained. And then once the legislature adjourned sine die, that was the end of it for this year. It'll have to be reintroduced this year.
Okay, because I was hearing that major companies such as Apple were telling Nebraska lawmakers that if they passed a right to repair bill, that it would make Nebraska sort of a hotbed for cybersecurity hackers or something like that?
Well, that's what some would claim. I'm not quite sure where that comes from, I guess. I'm just a farmer. I'm trying to get our job done and get it done, you know, as efficiently as we can. And so That's a little outside of my area of expertise.
Okay, fair enough. But let me ask you this, because we're going to talk about, I mean, we're focusing on John Deere right now, and we did reach out to them, and they declined, were unable to join us today. But Tom, let me ask you, there's so many issues here in this right to repair question, but I'm really interested to hear what you have to say about what Nathan was bringing up, that like you bought your tractor, you're the owner of it, but John Deere still asserts that they, you know, they own some of the stuff that's going on inside the tractor, and you're just an extended user of it. I mean, how does that make you feel? Or what's your response to that?
I kind of find it funny that, you know, we pay property taxes, personal property taxes on all our equipment. And so when my wife sits down at the end of the year, or middle of the year, I guess, and writes those checks out, I haven't noticed John Deere putting any money into that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure that as far as the state is concerned, I own that tractor, lock, stock, and barrel, as they would say. So I really question that with Deere. I understand that Deere's put a lot of money into developing that, and they want a return on their investment, and I get that. I don't have a problem with that. That's part of business. But what we want is access to that computer so that we don't want to change the software. We just want to be able to tell the software, we put a new component on, you need to work with it. And it's really almost that simple.
Right. Well, Tom Schwartz, fifth-generation farmer from Bertrand, Nebraska, president of the Phelps-Gosper County Farm Bureau, also has a seat on the American Farm Bureau as well. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're quite welcome.
It's been really great to have you. Nathan Proctor, one quick question here, though. We've been focusing a lot on John Deere. We'll talk about Apple when we come back. But didn't John Deere sort of strike an agreement recently with the California Farm Bureau?
So it's hard to describe quickly. John Deere has like kind of an optional self-imposed agreement to provide some of the stuff we need to repair, but not all of it by 2021. And inexplicably, California Farm Bureau said that's good enough for us. But a lot of other farm bureaus do not share that view.
I see. All right. Well, we are talking about the right to repair movement and how it's getting harder to fix your stuff in the digital age and people pushing back against that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the right to repair movement and why companies are making it harder than ever to fix your stuff and the pushback against that. I'm joined today by Nathan Proctor. He's director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair at the advocacy group, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. And this is a great unifier, this issue, Nathan, because we've got so many comments coming in online here. Let's give you a taste here. Joel Kimmel says, on Joel's 07 Buick Lucerne, the GM dealer charges Joel $270 to replace a $12 headlamp bulb because auto manufacturers design vehicles to keep dealership service departments fiscally afloat. Barton Farms and Gardens sent us a message on Facebook saying, quote, I can barely begin to describe the nightmare that has been our experience with LG. 5-year-old fridge stopped working in August. No local repair companies would work on it. They've had 7 tech visits, and the techs have told us it's a lemon and unrepairable as well here. So, Nathan, so beforehand we were talking with Tom Schwartz, who was telling us about farm equipment and how they've basically become like mobile technology units, really almost more than tractors. And the challenges he's facing there, but in everybody's homes, it feels like, especially with the expansion of the Internet of Things, this is a problem that we're encountering in items that we never thought would be difficult to repair.
Yeah, that's right. There's probably hundreds of things right now in your home that have some kind of circuit board in them, and things that used to have, you know, old-fashioned, analog, durable, mechanical parts, you know, now have. I mean, in toasters, I mean, we had a toaster at one of our, you know, kind of repair demonstrations, and, you know, there's a circuit board in there, and it toasted, as you might imagine. And because the manufacturer can control the, you know, replacement parts for that, you have to get a new toaster. I mean, that's just or you have to charge whatever they're going to charge. I mean, this is the problem of not having independent repair, is manufacturers can charge whatever they want to charge for you to fix the thing. And if they don't feel like fixing it, then you have to get a new item.
Yeah. And so the aspects of our life that it touches are so broad, because first of all, there's just the ownership question. We talked about that with Tom. Like, really, are we owners or just extended users of these items, everything from tractors to toasters? There's just the sheer disempowerment of not being able to fix your own stuff or feeling like you can't. And then there's the waste factor, right? I mean, we have Nate Beck here on our website saying the economic strategy of planned obsolescence has to be put aside as a method for increasing profits because the many ways in which it affects the environment, social justice, and affordability for people, the throwaway culture is just pernicious and destructive.
Oh, that is 100% true. Americans throw out 416,000 cell phones every single day. You know, we make these incredible, you know, $1,000 handheld supercomputers, and then we treat them as if they're essentially disposable. I mean, one cell phone is anywhere from 165 to like 500 pounds of raw material to construct it. 85% of the climate impact is the mining of that material. And then we, instead of fixing these things and keeping them going, we just toss them out. And it's completely unsustainable. It's very expensive. And Right to Repair as a movement is really us kind of resisting this push to treat everything as if disposable.
You know, we will talk about in detail in a few minutes the very clear reasons that a lot of these companies have for the practices that we're discussing here, cybersecurity, intellectual property, copyright. We'll talk about all those things. But can you give us some examples, Nathan, of what corporations are doing to make it more difficult to repair our stuff?
So there's a lot of examples. I'll start with you know, Right to Repair is basically asking for five things. So first, the thing that they do is they don't let us have the proper replacement parts. So if you – let's just say you need a new battery in your iPhone, Apple will not let the original Apple batteries be sold and replaced by any repair technicians except for authorized Apple repair technicians. You can't buy that battery.
And they also glue them in now in some of their phones.
Yeah, so Apple uses this adhesive tape, which is – tricky but not impossible to pull out. But a lot of these other devices are completely unrepairable by design. So they don't give us the parts. They don't give us the instructions. They used to come – when you used to get a piece of electronics, you'd get the, you know, technical manual that would tell you, you know, what circuit connected to what circuit, how to fix it, and how to troubleshoot it.
Can I give you a tiny example of that?
Sure.
Recently in my own life? So I bought new helmets for my kids, and they have an LED in the back so that, you know, the back of their little heads will flash red. Had no instructions with it whatsoever. And my first thought literally was like, well, how do I replace the battery when the LED battery gives out? It might be years from now, but I don't want to have to get a new helmet because the helmet might be fine. And I looked online and people had the same question and there was no answer for it. So a minor example, but it's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when you talk about Right to Repair, Right to Repair doesn't necessarily stop companies from designing things that are completely like instant e-waste, you know, as soon as, you know, gluing in the battery. But it does kind of build this expectation that people have that we can fix things, because we've kind of forgotten that. When you buy something, you should ask, if this breaks, am I going to be able to fix it? If this battery goes dead, do I know how to take it out?
Well, so can I give you some – it seems like there's other things as well that companies can do. They'll put locks on the firmware. If you try to even open up the back of your device or appliance, that it, sometimes that just automatically voids the warranty.
They say it voids the warranty. The Federal Trade Commission disagrees with that.
Okay, good. Because I was under the impression that it did.
You are not alone. No, the Federal Trade Commission sent out warning letters to six companies – in April saying you can't put those stickers on the on devices. People have a legal right to repair things without voiding their warranty. It's in the language of Magnuson-Moss, our warranty law.
Okay, so one more thing that specifically Apple does that people have been talking about recently, error 53.
Yeah.
What is that?
So Apple, you know, if you have an Apple phone and you crack the screen and you replace it or you have somebody else replace it, there's like a digital signature between the screen and the home button. And error 53 basically is what happened when Apple rolled out a new update to their operating systems. And if it detected a different digital signature between the home button and the glass, it basically deactivated the phone. So all of a sudden you say, oh, error 53, your phone doesn't work anymore. And this happened in, you know, kind of in to hundreds and thousands of people around the world. And they couldn't figure it out until someone figured it out. No, they're just turning off your phone if you dared to have somebody else fix the glass. And then Apple claimed that it was, you know, protecting your security.
Even if you used actual Apple glass as the replacement?
Yes, if it wasn't done by Apple with the technology to calibrate, technology they do not make available to other people, then the phone would not work.
Okay. Well, we have so many callers who want to join us. Let me just get a couple of them in here while I can. We're talking about the right to repair and the movement to be able to take back the power to fix your own stuff. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Richard is calling from Mystic, Connecticut. Richard, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thanks. You just talked about Apple shutting down, and that actually can be a safety issue, but I've got a bigger one. I live in a maritime community, and one of my colleagues has a boat that he repowered with the John Deere marine diesel a number of years ago. And he's constantly had problems with it, breaking down, has to get somebody to come 100 miles, this factory certified, to look at it. They still haven't been able to figure it out. But the big issue is John Deere will not allow a workaround. So if you're out in the middle of the ocean, you're calling about the boat or something, and your diesel breaks down, a diesel engine is the simplest thing to get going, except John Deere makes it impossible to fix while you're at sea, and that's life-threatening. You could go up on the rocks. You could lose your life.
Richard, has this happened? Has this happened? I'm sorry to interrupt, Richard, but has this happened to you?
No, this has happened to him, where it's broken down, and he's had to limp in ways that were, you know, he's not using his engine. If he were out in the middle of the storm, fortunately, it hasn't happened, so he hasn't lost his life.
Wow.
But he is very concerned. He's trying to figure out how he can repower the boat because he thinks the John Deere marine diesel is unsafe.
Wow.
We've actually been trying to get in touch with the Coast Guard. Their excuse, not the Coast Guard, but John Deere, is, oh, we have to have it this way because we have to meet certain standards for the environment, for energy efficiency and things like that. So we can't let you disable our computer system to be able to start it. Again, it would be very simple. If you could disable all the extra junk they put on and disable the computer, you could run a diesel engine all day long without any power except enough to start it.
But well, Richard, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. I'm going to take it back from you there, and thank you so much for your call. So Richard there talking about it could be a life and death situation when he's out at sea. Let's go to Benjamin, who's calling from Johnson City, Tennessee. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Go ahead.
Ultimately, I'm an Apple service technician at a local authorized provider here in Johnson City, and especially when it comes to Apple stuff, it's been a real hassle for a lot of people, where there's not an official Apple store within almost 150 miles of us. We get a lot of people who brought their stuff in, like, oh, you know, hey, I had to have my screen fixed at another store. I had my battery swapped out at, you know, so-and-so other retailer. And suddenly I have to tell these people, unfortunately, I can't work on your device anymore because Apple won't let me.
So, I mean, is that frustrating for you? Because I imagine you can fix this stuff.
Oh, it's incredibly frustrating. Because a lot of the times it's just like, oh, you know, I took it down to my friend who works on this stuff all the time, and all he did was open it. Unfortunately, from there, even then, Apple's just like, oh, hey, if it's a 6S or newer, they opened it and they can't put the adhesive back on, we can't say definitively they didn't do anything else. So it's going to be a whole phone replacement.
Yeah. Wow. Benjamin, thank you for your call. Nathan Proctor, what do you think?
I think there's a strong case that that's what is known as a tie-in sale through our antitrust laws, where you force someone to get connected sales when you sell them something. And that's, I don't think that's permissible by law. So there's a lot to address under our current laws, but it's clear that the boundaries for what we let companies do when it comes to controlling the way we use our stuff is totally out of whack.
Well, you know what? I want to bring in one more voice here into this conversation for a different view on the issue of right to repair. Earl Crane joins us. He's with us from Austin, Texas today. He's a cyber risk consultant for financial institutions, Fortune 100 companies, government, and he's also a security advisor for the industry advocacy organization, the Security Innovation Center. He served as director for federal cybersecurity policy in the Obama White House. Earl Crane, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
It's really great to have you. So you know, we've been criticizing the action of lots of corporations here with this right to repair issue. But as I said a little earlier, Apple, John Deere, auto manufacturers, the whole lot, they have specific reasons why they say they need to retain a lot of control over their products. And one of them is cybersecurity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, I'm happy to. I appreciate you bringing a cybersecurity voice into the conversation. You mentioned earlier that it's a unifying conversation. And I mean, as you mentioned, I live in Texas. I grew up in Ohio, and I really appreciate the independence and the self-reliance of everyone that works on their own devices, from farmers to the whole repair community. And in cybersecurity, we have makers, we have hackers, we have tinkerers, we have people that live around that whole self-reliance component as well. Some of the cybersecurity considerations come in is this is a more complex issue than just an individual wanting to repair their device. I have no issues with individuals wanting to get their devices repaired in a small shop. The concern is around the risk that it introduces to organizations where they might bring those devices in, part of bring your own device, and then also the risk that it introduces because we're all an internet-connected world as part of a shared ecosystem.
Okay, so basically saying that if we let individuals fix/hack their own devices, that could end up being a cybersecurity risk for their employers if they bring those devices in. But isn't it the responsibility of employers and companies to maintain as secure a cyber environment within their own walls or networks as possible?
Well, so it's a great point about accountability, right? And so one of the key things is that we want to be able to provide security and have accountability for the security that an organization needs to provide. And if you ask any cybersecurity professional, if I can get my hands on the device, I have a much higher likelihood and a strong advantage in compromising the integrity of that device. So organizations are responsible through bring your own device policies. When I was in federal government, we worked for a long time on how we could bring consumer devices into the federal government, into the enterprise, commercial enterprise as well, so that they would be usable for consumers and also part of the a secure connected enterprise ecosystem for those companies.
Okay. You know, Earl Crane, forgive me for saying this, but I see your point, but it also seems to be sort of beside the point, because if we're talking about hackability, the Internet of Things, every baby monitors are so incredibly hackable as it is, that isn't this kind of a canard? I mean, it just seems like a distraction from the real issue here, which is that companies are trying to make it hard for people to just fix their stuff so they can exercise ownership over it and then also perhaps continue to profit from those things, whether it's through inflated service prices or the, you know, planned obsolescence that we've been talking about.
Almost, but not quite. I'm not able to really talk to industry policies or the way vendors provide different consumer or customer service or vendor pricing. I'm not an expert in that area. But One thing that we've seen time and time again is that when we push better security principles and better security programs, be they through, I mentioned, bring your own device, or if they go through cloud computing, that the security requirements driven by corporations and driven by the federal government make their way into consumer products. So if you look at consumer products, look at mobile devices today, they have much better security controls than they did 10 years ago.
Well, Earl Crane, cyber risk consultant and advisor for the industry advocacy organization, the Security Innovation Center, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, we were talking about the right to repair movement and how it's getting harder, especially in the digital age, to fix your stuff. We'll get to a lot of more callers when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about the right to repair movement and how hard it's getting to fix your stuff in the digital age and how companies are making it even harder. Nathan Proctor is with us. He's director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair at the advocacy group, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. And Nathan, stand by here for a couple of seconds because the phones have lit up. Surprise, surprise. Let's go to Teresa, who's calling from Middlebury, Vermont. Teresa, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me. I'm so excited that you guys are talking about this. I, myself, like your guest Tom, was asked by two state senators to testify in front of the state of Vermont legislature about this very topic. And we had a conversation on VPR, and there's just so many aspects of life where this comes into play. And I, myself, own a computer and cell phone repair shop. And I see these problems every single day. And really where it's become frustrating is, obviously, I'm kind of on the cusp of, well, maybe I won't have a job in 5 years because I won't be able to do much with people's devices.
Right.
But not only that, you see people, you know, spending thousands of dollars. I had a customer come in just the other day with a brand new iPad Pro 12-inch. And his charging port wouldn't work. And he asked me, hey, how much is it going to cost to fix this? And I had to basically explain to him that not only was this device glued together, but the soldering or the charging port is now soldered in versus, you know, years ago when you could kind of remove the screen and a lot of the parts were kind of in with pop connectors.
Yeah.
Made things a lot easier to fix. But now, you know, people are having to throw these devices away. And the sad thing is Apple's not even really fixing these devices themselves. I've called on behalf of customers, and they said, well, you can give us $250, and we'll just replace the device.
Wow. Okay. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for your call. Again, I keep thinking, Nathan, as you talked about earlier, about the waste this is generating when these things are imminently repairable. So let's go to Gerald, who's calling from Orlando, Florida. Gerald, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing great. What's your thought?
I was calling because I completely understand, the callers about Apple and about John Deere. I am an 18-wheeler truck driver, okay? And with 18-wheeler truck drivers, it's the very same thing, situations that people are dealing with when it comes to repairs like John Deere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these tractors are so computerized these days, it's ridiculous. You know, back in the olden days, you know, I could repair my own truck, you know, maybe I would say 60-70%, you know, of my own truck, you know, because I'm very handy, you know, and, you know, so it makes it very difficult because, you know, the drivers are in the hands of, you know, the shops.
Yeah.
And, you know, when my truck is not going down the road, I'm not making any money, you know, because I own my own truck. So if I'm not driving down the road, I'm not making any money. And it all depends on, you know, where you go, you know, what shop you go to or whatever, you know.
And it gets tough. It sounds like it's getting tougher and tougher. And again, Gerald, thank you for your call. Just like Nathan, what Tom was telling us earlier, Tom in Nebraska, that it's gotten so bad that when their equipment breaks down and they are not allowed to fix it, that's money flow out of their pocket. So let's take one more call here at least. Daniel is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. So I had a 2015 MacBook Pro and I spilled some water on it by accident. I did some research online and I found that there's a piece inside the MacBook Pro called a trackpad cable that's very susceptible to water damage. Pretty much I could turn on the laptop, but the keyboard and mouse stopped working. So I just want to confirm the suspicion. I brought it to the Apple store and the clerk that I was speaking to told me, we'll replace the trackpad cable for $80. If it works, you can pay it and that's fine. If it doesn't work, we won't charge you anything and we'll go from there. And I thought this was great. So I left it at the Apple store for a week. I came back on Friday. I picked it up and alas, it had not replaced the trackpad cable. All they did was tell me that there was water damage, which I already knew. So I was pretty annoyed at this. I brought it home. I did some research. I ordered the trackpad cable on Amazon for just $10. I opened up the laptop. I replaced it myself. I fixed it. And a year later, the computer's working great.
Daniel, did you have the right screwdriver to take the back off your MacBook Pro?
So I also had to purchase that, which cost $5.
Okay. Wow. So basically a $15 or $17 fix for something that Apple wanted to charge you more than $800 for.
$850 was the cost. And they heavily advised me not to open it myself because if I had done that, then they weren't going to be able to help me at all.
Wow.
So yeah, $850, then I should fix it for $12. Strongly advocate trying to fix it yourself.
Daniel, thank you so much for your call. Nathan Proctor, let me turn back to you here. We could go on and on and on here because I think the phones are still full. We'll try to get to more people when we can. But one thing that I want to explore a little bit with you is in the digital age, unlike in the purely analog age, I mean, I have a great amount of sympathy for everyone out there who is capable of repairing things. You know, we were hearing from our caller who drives a truck in Florida saying he used to be able to get out and fix his truck. But we do have basically things that are rolling pieces of technology these days. I mean, auto manufacturers would like to classify their cars as mobile technology devices. And so there is proprietary material in there. There is proprietary code. Do these companies not have a solid argument to make that under things like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, that they can exercise copyright control over the intellectual property in their products? And that's one of the reasons why they need to keep us, the owners and users of it, out of those products.
Yeah. You know, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was created to prevent people from pirating video games and music and, you know, movies. It was, you know, to protect Britney Spears' brand. And it's being used to as a weapon against basically control over anything electronic. I don't think that and this has been borne out with this process where the Librarian of Congress has been asked to issue exemptions to copyright protections for some of the software that runs on you know, all the other devices we have that does all kinds of other things that we actually have the legal right in most cases to hack the software for the purposes of repair because it's our stuff. Their copyright does not extend to let them block us from opening up our, you know, our own thing and doing whatever we want with it because we own it. Mm. But, you know, of course they did – you know, create the software and they have some rights there. But, you know, I think the idea that we need to infringe on those rights just to fix things is not really true, right? We don't need – we just need the tools to fix the technology. We need the parts. We need the diagnostic software that they make available to all their techs. We need to be able to, you know, reset the firmware if there's some kind of, you know, kind of block to, you know, the device starting up again. And once we have that, you know, we don't need anything else.
So we have seen some changes, though. We've seen at least industry organizations show some responsiveness to this, because in 2012, the state of Massachusetts passed an automobile right to repair law, which a lot of people looked at as sort of being on the vanguard of this pushback against corporations. And if I have this right, soon after that, didn't many of the national automotive groups actually come together and sign or at least agree to a memorandum of understanding that would allow, beginning in model year 2018, automakers would have to be required to kind of offer some standard non-proprietary interfaces so that repair people other than dealers could get into cars to fix them?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, in fact, that's where our state push for right to repair kind of came from. That was the idea that started this, like, why are we trying to pass state laws to give us access to parts, tools, you know, diagnostics, you know, necessary for repair. Was this had started happening in auto dealerships where, you know, they do set the car up in such a way that you have to take it to the dealer to get certain repairs done. Your local mechanic couldn't, basically your check engine light would go on and they wouldn't have the port to plug in to read what was wrong with the car, and they might be locked out of the basic repair functionality to then fix it, which would force people to go to the dealers. And 86% of Massachusetts voters voted in 2012 that that should not be the case. We should be able to take our car to the mechanic of our choice.
Yeah. So are we seeing since then more states have passed similar legislation, right?
So there's a national agreement on cars based on the Massachusetts law. There's still some issues that are, you know, kind of going back and forth on, but it's certainly better, you know, this has made a big difference. But in terms of the rest of the world of electronics, you know, 19 states have introduced bills. And this has been a quick ramp up. Like, there was like 6 3 years ago, and then a dozen 2 years ago, and then this last year we've had 19. So there's a ton of interest. You know, Vermont's doing an active study right now. We haven't yet to pass this in any state.
I see.
But, you know, the momentum is, you know, kind of huge behind this right now.
Okay, so let's get some more callers in here. Roger is calling from Gettysburg, South Dakota. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Roger.
Go ahead, Roger.
Okay. Well, what I want to relate is a couple of years ago, I had a Sears Craftsman air compressor, a small air compressor, which failed on me. And when looking into what it was, I found a tiny thermal switch, which had failed. So I went down to the local Sears repair shop, which actually has all the parts and the service people there. And they were unable to get the thermal switch. That's not a repairable part. So I said, well, what is repairable? And they looked up on their, you know, on their diagrams, this and that. And their final answer was the only repairable part is the entire air compressor. And so I did go down to the Radio Shack and found a thermal switch and got it replaced and everything worked. But I just thought the irony of, you know, we know where Sears is these days, not doing too well. Radio Shack, similarly, not doing too well, and it does frustrate me. I, little older generation and used to repairing things, so
yeah.
It is frustrating and it quite disturbing that so many things go into landfills which are quite repairable.
Roger, thank you so much for your call. Roger's comment reminds me of something that on our website Patrick S. is saying. I mean, Roger grew up fixing things. He called himself the older generation. But Patrick S. says, people who like to fix things and tinker are a dwindling population that our economy isn't likely to respond to. Patrick says, fix your own appliance or tractor? Seriously, I know many adults who don't even own tools. But Nathan Proctor, though, there is this sort of burgeoning grassroots movement, though, I mean, I don't know if that's the right thing to call it, of repair and fix-it centers, though, that have been popping up across the country. Haven't there been?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would encourage anyone, if they have a broken device, to check out to see if there is a local pop-up community event where you can take devices in and get coaching from an expert on how to fix it. So there's the Fix-It Clinic Network, and they have them in Boston. There's repair cafes, and then there's also something called the Restart Project. And, yeah, I think...
Well, and iFixit also is a huge company now, right?
Yeah, iFixit is the online open source manual for fixing everything, and it's spectacular. I think companies are really trying to design products, so they have this black box mystique to them, and people think, oh, this iPhone is this shiny rectangle. I can't possibly get inside it, but it's just a battery and a motherboard and a couple ports and some cables that connect it. There's a mystique to the complicated nature of the technology that once you actually open one of these up and fix it for yourself, you'll realize that, you know, it's not as hard as they try to make it
seem. But, you know, I feel sympathy for a lot of people who even with the mystique, but also just the cost of these devices. Maybe yeah. There's a lot of folks out there who are like, I cannot risk repairing this myself because if I screw it up, there goes $900.
Well, Right to Repair also helps that extensively. I mean, I think for those of you who haven't seen, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation had a little expose where they took a broken Apple laptop to the Apple store, and they were told it was going to be $1,200 or more to fix, and they were recommended to you know, maybe explore buying a new computer. They took it to an independent technician who had the computer fixed in 90 seconds, and he said he wouldn't normally charge for that. So I think... You know, you don't have to become a technician yourself to benefit from this, but it's like repair options are critical to give, you know, so that you know when you have something, like, and the manufacturer tells you to get a new one, that's not the end of the story. Maybe somebody else would be willing to fix that or refurbish it and sell it, you know, et cetera. But we need control over it. I mean, you take the story of the guy out at sea.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
John Deere saying you're not allowed to have control over your own engine at sea because, you know, you might hurt the environment. It's like we should be able to decide for ourselves what to do with the technology that we buy.
Right. You know, and you mentioned that Canadian Broadcasting Corporation video, their news story, the CBC story. We actually have a link to it if people want to watch at our website, onpointradio.org. And you definitely do see a different person after they go to the Apple store and they say $1,200 to fix it. And then they go to this other guy who like takes the back off the MacBook and straightens out a pin. And all of a sudden this, the monitor or the screen of this laptop works really, really well. So, but finally, just my last question to you, Nathan, do you think, like you said, there's a lot of momentum here, but there's also a lot of power with these corporations. And I wasn't joking with Tom at the beginning of the show when I said that, you know, it was reported that when Nebraska was trying to pass its right to repair law, that Apple did go in and told legislators that, you know, it could actually leave Nebraska vulnerable, making it a hotbed for hackers. So is there a corporate pushback to the right to repair pushback, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, every time I walk into a state legislature, I'm opposed by trillions upon trillions of dollars worth of companies. And I counted up in New York, and the companies that registered to lobby against Right to Repair added up to $2.5 trillion in market cap. So, yeah, they want to maintain control, and it's, you know, it's us versus them. You know, we think we should have a right to repair things.
Well, Nathan Proctor is director of the Campaign for the Right to Repair at the advocacy group, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. Nathan Proctor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
I'm going to give the last thought to Stephanie Dunn, who sent this to us on Twitter. Stephanie says, can't tell you how good I felt after we fixed our dead oven by soldering a circuit board connection. It felt like beating a bully. More power to you, Stephanie. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.